Accession number 10429, rule 7.
Well, we were involved with training the then combined Indian Air Force, which was very much a growing force with a number of, to use the proper term in those days, Indianized stations like Kohat on the frontier and so on. And we had also a mixture of RAF and Indian Air Force squadrons doing what was called watch and ward on the frontier, okay, well, on the frontier with Afghanistan, stretching right round the whole of the, of course, the north of India, right round. There were two other groups in the south, but we were the flying training and operational group. Now, we had a number of incidents there, one I won't go into in detail. We had our usual row with one of the big tribes, the Marsuds in Waziristan, who'd captured inadvertently, to their dismay, a commissioner rather than the engineer they set out to be, and held him to ransom, which was not those things that should be done. And we issued the normal, because they wouldn't cough him up. We dropped usual warning notices that unless they coughed him up, we would bomb their village there, and then red notice tell them to clear out of the village. And we had quite a little contest, destroying seven villages. It was very difficult with mud walls about 5 foot thick, even with rockets and things to bomb, bring down the things, which was the way to give them enough to do, to keep them preoccupied for some time as a punishment. Eventually, we did do that. I wanted to make history because we had some Halifaxes without proper bomb racks, and we had 4,000 pounders, and I wanted to drop a 4,000 pounder on one of these villages, which reverberated in all the mountains all around Waziristan, which really made the thing. Unfortunately, we missed the boat, but we dropped a demonstration one at the Staff College at Quetta, and it took me 30 years afterwards to hear it blew all windows out. But the reason I'm mentioning this particular incident, because Tedder was after all deputy to Eisenhower during the war, quoted it on a visit as the first instance of the Royal Air Force really being able to come successfully conclude a frontier operation without the use of the army. The normal thing would have happened was that the army would have sent up a division all the way up through the passes, which of course had been enticed all the other tribes to join in the fun and shoot them up, because the Waziristan had 3 million armed men, and as the Mujahideen in Afghanistan are all Pathans of the same ilk, see what warlike and incredibly brave and strong men they are, very much more kin to us than many other races. And that was it, but it was just for the quote, the first case.
Which year was that?
This was 1946. At the end of 1940, I was as an acting group captain, senior air staff officer. At the end of, I was lucky because I was still holding on to my acting rank. And they hadn't been able to find a substantive post-war, needed to go revert to substantive ranks, group captain to take my place. But they did in 47, and I was then posted as air advisor to the Northern Command of India, which was at Rawalpindi, about 100 miles plus from Peshawar, still on the virtually on the frontier, not very far from, of course, Kashmir. Now the capital virtually was this new Islamabad of Pakistan. Now this was a period when things were getting worse, because Jinnah was rampaging around Pakistan, Vindabad, this efforts to segregate what was Pakistan now and Bengal from India. There have been attempts to make Nehru the Prime Minister of all India, and we had the dreadful experience of having Stafford Cripps and pathetic Laurie Snowcombe came out on a mission. Instead of going around to see how effectively we'd Indianize, for instance, Army and Air Force stations, spent their times in the bazaars, coveting around with the riffraff and so on. A pathetic experience. And they went back. All this was this move for Indian independence, which we realized was inevitable. The Indians were rapidly getting to the stage where they could take on all reins of office, because the police was virtually Delhi was, most of the government offices were run by Indians and so on, very effective. We had Indian squadrons, Indian stations and so on, and it was only a question of when. But the date was originally set, and I went because to Rawalpindi as air advisor, because things got steadily worse. There was all this rumour and counter-rumour, and leading up to thoughts of independence, where the Muslims in what was to become Pakistan heard of outrages of Muslims being slaughtered in Calcutta or where have you, and those in Calcutta heard of Hindus being herded and Sikhs being herded up in temples and slaughtered up in the north. And rumour and counter-rumour, thanks to the media, which of course before the war had never entered into it, it generated tremendous interest and a virtual media war, plus rumour and counter-rumour, plus of course actual fisticuffs. And it got steadily worse, and I went with the Commander-in-Chief Northern Army, General Frank Meservey, and the Brigadier General Staff down to live with the Governor in Lahore to form a little forward operations room. But things were getting so poor, communications were so difficult, that we went back after about 2 or 3 months, I think, to Rawalpindi. Then, as everybody knows, Wavell was the tremendous character who was the viceroy, and it was decided that the handover would be agreed to 1948, not 1947, and the Attlee government appointed Lord Mountbatten to take over from Wavell, as on the television box time and again Mountbatten said that he was given carte blanche because he did demand that he didn't have to refer all his decisions and so on to the cabinet. And I am a result of this experience. I had been flying to and fro down to Regde to for a year before in 1946 to do planning operations to counteract any great uprising, and this was planning operations for the army down in India, GHQ, to stockpile the cantonments around, particularly up in the north and everywhere else, with water and petrol and ammunition and foodstuffs and so on, to prepare for the possible event of disruption of road communications, rail, telegraph and so on, where we would have also of course air communications all still going strong. And even when the worst of things happened, we depended on the loyalty of the Indian Army as it was then, and they were mixed battalions, and there was never any question to doubt their loyalty and integrity. But things got steadily worse. And what Mountbatten did, for which he shall never be forgiven, was to bring the date forward by 1 year to August the 15th or something or other, 1947. because he said on the box that they were concerned about the thing going anti-British. Well, of course, we've been preparing for that very thing, and we were perfectly confident we could hold any nonsenses that went on, any sort of attacks. And it was more likely to be, as the events only proved too clearly, that it was Muslims against the Hindus and the Sikhs, and vice versa. And the first thing, of course, this arbitrary date was settled. The first thing happened, all the police and hierarchy in the various provinces stood down, the British policemen many times, handed over to people who came from 1,000 miles or more away, rapidly voted overnight, with no handing over, taking over period, and some of them quite untrained and incompetent take over senior position overnight, and in the middle of a vast insurrection. And the army, the Muslims, of course, being the virtual subservient classes in India, servants and what have you, tried to migrate across, get up north to go to Pakistan, and as was to be, the frontier being virtually as it is now, and of course had to run the gauntlet of the Sikh states on the way up, and they were slaughtered right, left and centre. At one time we used bulldozers to clear the dead between Lahore and Amritsar. They got so worked up and so berserk that you know, women were, it didn't matter whether it was a Muslim, Hindu or Sikh or what, they were women dismembered, run through with stakes and so on. It was an unholy, merciless slaughter. Now, as against that, the particularly the Sikhs in the Punjab, which was a granny of India, were retreating south into Sikh states with convoys 40 miles long, ox-cart convoys, loaded with grain, of course, and they're all armed with their religious swords and the kirpan and so on. So they were well protected against any Muslim attacks, whereas the unfortunate Muslims walking north, coming up on trains, even though they put army guards on the trains, they were slaughtered on the trains time and again. Various towns and things with remaining populations, there was massacres galore. In other words, about 6 million people were trying to cross migrate. In the middle of all this came floods, and to my mind, if we stuck to the original 48, we could have had a more orderly thing, more orderly general. There would have been continued slaughter, but nothing to the extent there was. And, of course, other things happened. By the partition, it was agreed, for instance, that armaments and things would be shared out. Well, at the time, of course, we had most of the towns up north, all the depots bulging with stuff that nobody knew what was in the packing cases of. Time was going to be shared out. What came up north was boxes of stones. And otherwise the stockpiles of all the stuff was down in India. And I always remember one delightful thing when the Indians claimed, for instance, 4,000 pounders that we were dumping in the sea, and we charged them for it. And But they had no possible means of carrying them. There were a number of significant things in that time. Apart from this awful, the slaughter may have been up to 1 million. Nobody knows. The army, I used to daily, of course, being in the army headquarters, which became, on partition, GHQ Pakistan. I used to read the daily intelligence reports. And the army was spread out over an area the size of Europe in penny packets. They couldn't count head counts. They did 400 here, 200, 300 here. And it was quite impossible to really keep them adequately supplied. That's why they were spread all over, trying to maintain some sort of semblance of order, but an impossible task. No, we don't know what the casualties were, but the point is, of course, what's 1 million dead to India? and it will be lost in history. But we felt at the time very conscious of the fact that a crisis had been precipitated by Mountbatten, of course, and grateful India made him the first Governor General. After partition, I can remember the first consequences. I went on leave up the hills in Topa, and I also remember them being highly amused because the whole province had gone dry, but it meant in the club that an order was whiskey and soda in a coffee pot. Because behind the scenes, of course, the even the Orthodox Muslims still like their grog. But Douglas Gracey, General Sir Douglas Gracey, had taken over from Frank Meservey. And I always remember one night there was I was nearly called out to go down with Douglas Gracey to Karachi, where Jinnah was, and from Rawalpindi, which was over 1,000 miles apart, because Jinnah wanted to go to war with India. And Gracey had to prevail on him that he hadn't got the resources. He may have had a number of 10 and things to conduct any warlike operations. And so reason prevailed, and that was prevented. I don't know to what extent and what the intentions were at all. But there were a number of odd incidents. One was when the tribesmen of Waziristan were unofficially allowed to mount an expeditionary force up the Vale of Kashmir. This meant right crossing the whole of north of Pakistan on what was an expedition aimed at trying to prevent India taking over Kashmir, a state which one of those many running sores that we'd left at the time of partition unresolved. Anyway, they worked their way up the Vale of Kashmir, and of course had great joy in not massacring the inhabitants because they're all Muslims, but overcoming outposts of the Maharajas and loading themselves up with some with half a dozen rifles with worth their weight in gold in Waziristan. But as they neared Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir, there was a great argument started between the as to the objectives. One lot wanted to take over the treasury and the other one to take over the armory, and they were divided over their objectives. Whereas, of course, there were a number of Pakistani officers who were on leave from our headquarters. We knew, I was in the delightful position of being a neutral, but I knew exactly where they were. They were with the tribal expeditionary force trying to maintain the military objectives. And of course, the main military objective was to get to Srinagar airfield, which the Indians, being alerted, flew in, not being able to use RAF aircraft, collected all the civil airliners and flew a brigade into Srinagar airfield, thereby forestalling the Pakistanis' intention, which is the reason why, of course, to this day, Kashmir, a Muslim state, is split down virtually the middle. But I was very interested some year or so ago when the discovery of immense wealth, treasure in the treasury in Srinagar, been hidden for years, of great significance in trunks of going back from many, many years. And there was a considerable argument over to who owned it and so on. But I also thought, well, that was something that the loot that the tribesmen had missed. But one effect of this possible continued war in Kashmir was that we were asked to evacuate the British residents. Hells of a lot had retired, because Kashmir is a delightful country, and climate, delightful country. A lot of people retired there, and we had to mount an expedition force. And the RAF, of course, still remaining there, was only really neutral force, because there were no British Army units, and no one else sufficient. Anyway, we mounted a bus operation. And they were bought, families would leave. Unfortunately, rules made as they were eventually going to be airlifted, they couldn't bring their dogs with them, of course, made forced a number of people to stay behind anyway. But we did have quite a bus convoy all the way through the from Srinagar in the Indian held area and through down the Vale of Kashmir down to Rawalpindi. So it was a unique RAF bus convoy. Anyway, that was just a few instances of interesting time in India.